Now for the main message, Mr. Buchanan.
Sorry, that keeps me relatively on schedule. When we were in El Paso last week, I kind of teased the title of the sermon today. I brought these notes up, and I give Terry a copy, and it's for a good thing. I mean, she keeps me on track. She'll give me a kind of a weird sign every so often if I don't know what she's talking about sometimes with the head shaking and cut this and do that and everything. It's kind of weird, but anyway, sometimes it works. So I'll give a shout out to Zach Capindo in El Paso. And Zach, I kind of teased the title, but you didn't know it at the time, so we'll just see if you can remember this, Zach. It was a hot, muggy afternoon in late May. The year was 1969. I'll promise not to break out into a Bryan Adams song, for those of you that are musically inclined. Yes? No? Do you have Summer of 69 queued up, Joe? No? Okay. That's a good song. It's a rock song, but it's a good song. Oh, thankfully, yeah, Sheila knows it. Yeah, and you went to Ambassador Bible Center, so I was a junior in high school. We were in a five-team track meet in Southern Maryland. We'd left after lunchtime. Back then, we didn't know as much about being hydrated as we do now. And by we, I mean probably just me personally. We took care of hydration with salt tablets back in those days. And that's salt. Remember that? Salt. That was what would keep you hydrated. Not drinking water as much. Salt was important. Salt tablets were important. Well, my event was a 2 mile, and it was one of the last events of the day. It was hot, and it's unlike, you know, we're getting into some humidity now, but it was pretty warm, and it was really humid that day. And my event was one of the last of the day. It was the last before they had the relay type races, so I'm kind of hanging around all afternoon, getting hot and getting less hydrated as the afternoon goes on, and losing more water. And you're a sissy to drink water back in those days at sporting events. It wasn't really, no, not always, but I don't know. This is the only way I can trace what actually happened after that time. And I was doing well in my event, and it's an 8-lap race. 8 laps around a quarter-mile track, 2 miles. And we were in the 6th lap, coming into the end of the 7th lap. And I was near the lead. I wasn't on the lead, but I was pretty close. It was kind of, there was a tight bunch of about 12 or 13 runners from 5 different schools. And I'd stayed, if you're familiar with the track, it has lines on it, right? I had stayed right on the inside of that white line, that first lane. And so clear sailing, it was really, you know, I was in my element. I was going, even though I didn't know I was dehydrated. I probably was. And I was beginning to get a little weak going into that last lap. So we headed into the end of the 7th lap. And you know what happens then? Crack. It's called a gun lap. Any race that has more than 2 laps, on that last lap, the starter's pistol goes off, and I began to find out something that I hadn't discovered in the previous 7 laps, that there was a little bit of local knowledge with that asphalt track for this particular school. I think it was Poolsville, Maryland. You can look it up. We didn't often have track meets that far south, but we went to Poolsville. And as soon as that gun went off, you've seen it happen in track meets at higher levels, okay, in the Olympics and stuff like that. You've watched that. It gets exciting, begins to get a little bit more tense. And as soon as you cross that end of that 7th lap, boy, the starter's pistol goes off. It's the gun lap, and people begin to jockey for position, especially in a long race like that. And you know, started to get bunched up. People were starting to sprint. You try to get out ahead. You try to get away from people that are going to knock you over or something. And it almost happened to me. And then I discovered right on the inside turn, right after the starter's pistol, a little bit of local knowledge that some of the boys from Poolsville, Maryland knew about, but I didn't. There was a huge dip on the far inside of the track, right next to where the concrete goes to, you know, the beginning of the lane. But there was a dip. It was probably about the length of this lectern, and it went way down. Somehow it happened. The ground sank or something. They just ignored it, and the guys that were there locally or from that area knew that, and I didn't. And we were starting to shove in. People were hammering. I mean, people can push you. You know, the refs don't see it, or the officials don't see it. People can push you. And I got pushed from behind, and I stumbled onto this dip in the track, which I hadn't seen before because I was on the far right-hand side of that inside lane. And I almost sprained my ankle going down. And, kind of got bumped from behind again because I'd slowed down, almost fell down. And it was, you know, just from that point on, going through that entire turn at the top, there was a lot of jostling and shoving. And again, the upshot is I finished fourth. And somebody with local knowledge and sharp elbows finished first. Afterwards, I was kind of wandering around. This is where we get into the dehydration aspect. I'm kind of wandering around, glazed eyes, I'm sure, and somebody says, "Are you okay?" Somebody gave me some of that new stuff. It was called Gatorade, invented in 1965. It really hadn't caught on just yet, but I was dizzy. I was feeling sick. Went under the bleachers to try to cool off. Sat there for a few minutes and then threw up. Second time I tasted Gatorade in 10 minutes. We'd had Sloppy Joe's for lunch. I don't think I've had a Sloppy Joe since that time. Well, several years later, I came into the church. But, 1969. The only other time I felt sick again like that was my uncle. I went down to Florida to spend the summer with my uncle and his family. And he was a rising executive in a land development company. And during the time, in the middle of the time when I was there, we went to the Cayman Islands. The Cayman Islands were pretty primitive back then. There weren't any massive, great resorts and hotels like there are now. But the only other time I felt that sick that summer was when we went out to a five-star restaurant. There couldn't have been more than one on the island because the population was even sparser now than it is today. And my uncle was always, it was a pretty posh restaurant. The waiters were all dressed in tuxes and tails and bow ties and white shirts, and maitre d' was dressed to the hilt. And my uncle was always good at trying new things. And when we'd go out to dinner with him, he'd order for everybody. He'd order everybody something different. And for me, he ordered lobster. And I ate the lobster, rich, buttery lobster. And, of course, I wasn't in the church, didn't know anything about clean and unclean food, so I get a pass on this one time. But, the next day I got sick. I was sick for about 3 days afterwards. We were there for 3 weeks, so it didn't really impact. 3 week vacation. Who takes a 3 week vacation? But we were there on that little island for 3 weeks, and for a portion of it, I was sick as a dog. Reminded me of my race back in Poolsville, Maryland. Well, a few years after that, after high school, I came into the church. And with the things that were going on in the world at that time, with so many things happening, there was, constant unrest in the Middle East, the problem of Vietnam, problems in the United States. 1968 was a pretty big year for rebellion in the United States, political unrest and hippies and flower power, but then a lot of radicals and nuts who actually the ones who came into power here about 8 years ago, but they grew up. But anyway, I digress. In the Church of God during those years, we heard a lot about the gun lap. The gun lap. You remember that? The gun lap. I've done an extensive search on the website of Worldwide Church of God Worldwide Church of God literature, and you can't find it. although I'm sure there are coworker letters, it covers all that stuff. I can't find it. Can't find any references to the gun lap, but I know it was there. Maybe it was just in the Bible studies and sermons I heard Mr. Armstrong talk about, but we talked about the gun lap a lot. And why did we talk about the gun lap, and what was that metaphor used for? Well, the gun lap was used to indicate that as we were preaching the gospel as a church, as we were promulgating the good news of the coming kingdom of God to the world, that it was imminent, that we were in that last lap. It was as if as a church we heard the starter's pistol go off, and we were in the gun lap. So for many years, many of us were on the gun lap. Now, whenever this phrase was mentioned back during those days, there was an accompanying sense of urgency about doing the work of God. It turned out to be a very long gun lap. I would define it as the period from when the church began to grow exponentially, which you can trace back to the time of the late 1940s, the 50s, 60s, kind of plateauing in the 70s when that rapid growth began to tail off. But I'll also stress that these are just some of my opinions, personal observations, my memory, just like my memory of the track meet. It's really vivid in my own mind, but I'm sure that where it's not factual, I've just used my imagination to fill in the blanks. But I'm pretty sure I'm correct. But today, what I would like to do with you, because we've got a new generation of young people, we've got our own kids that, you know, some were a part of that gun lap. The memory of that gun lap is maybe in their minds, but we've got other people who aren't. A newer generation, different people, different folks. I'd like to address what we learned from the gun lap. Some positive things that we learned about the gun lap and what we can pass on to the next generation. There were some exciting times during those years. There were some good things, and I believe that some of the lessons that we can embrace today as a church are ones that those of us who have been around for quite a while remember very, very vividly. All a part of being on the gun lap of the work of God. So how did the phrase the gun lap originate in the Church of God, first of all? Well, there's a very good reason for it. During the 1950s through the 1970s, and some of you are going to find this very hard to believe, I know, maybe anyone that listens in, you're going to find it a little bit hard to know, but if you were there, you'll know that I'm not just using my imagination, it's actually factual. The Church of God was in a huge growth mode. For a little small group, oh wow. We had three college campuses in the mid-1960s, each of them with an enrollment of between 250 and 400 people. That was in the mid-1960s, Big Sandy being established in 1964 or 1965. Brickett Wood had been established in 1960, and the Ambassador College in Pasadena, California began in the late 40s in 1947. We were adding offices around the world. And along with those offices, we were adding churches and church areas, and ministers were being ordained and sent out to far-flung areas of the world. We had our own printing presses. And I'm not talking about something that might fit on this tabletop. I'm talking about printing presses that would fill half this room, at least, maybe this entire room. Four color web presses, the kind that the best ones were made in Germany. And we had that duplicated in Pasadena, in Radlett, England, and also in Australia, because to effectively get your magazines out to the vast areas of the world that we were covering, I mean, back in those days, shipping being what it was, we had to have those production facilities in three different areas to get the magazines out in a timely fashion. They were the very best presses in the world, and they printed three magazines at one time. At its height, we were printing The Good News, The Plain Truth magazine, and Tomorrow's World. And it was incredible. I had worked in the printing industry as a pressman's helper when I was a kid while I was going to college back in Maryland. And I had, it was a different type of press, but pretty similar. There were, you know, four and five webs of paper that would be directed in, and it was a pretty complex thing, mechanically speaking. And I had worked there for a summer. Sometimes I'd work two shifts. So I knew a little bit about the printing industry. And so when I went to Ambassador College as a student, one of my first jobs was being a janitor in the press room. And it was massive. It was a massive building with massive presses and these three magazines rolling off. And my boss gave me this job one day. Well, you know, in the printing industry, there's a lot of dust that is created, paper dust that is created. And a lot of this dust had accumulated in this huge, large printing facility in Radlett, England, and on top of the lights. You know, they had the lights hanging down, and there was, and so he said, he gave me this huge vacuum cleaner and said, I want you to go around the shop. Now, it wasn't a shop. It was like the size of maybe half of a Costco. It was that big. It was big, filled with printing presses and all kinds of other machines used in the printing industry. He said, now there's dust up there, and I want you to vacuum it off. I just did what I was told. About an hour later into my shift, my boss waved me off the job. He says, we didn't have such a good idea. I'm thinking, I didn't. You just told me. That was your idea, buddy. So because in doing what I did, it knocked a lot of that dust off into the ink wells and the bins and everything, probably ruined a couple of production runs, you know, of spoiling the ink. So, but it was big. The point is, it was huge. Those of you that weren't there, you can't imagine the size and the scope of what was happening with this church and how it was growing. And we were adding congregations all over the world every year, year upon year, from the late 40s, the 50s. This church in Tucson, Worldwide Church of God, was number 56 in the nation. And I can't remember what year it was established, probably the early 60s, sometime 61 or 2, and along with Phoenix. Phoenix was probably first. This was a satellite church along with a minister that was assigned. I think Mr. Hargrove, the first, was he the first pastor or... No. It wasn't Turk. He wasn't the first, no.
Thomas?
Phoenix. Keith Thomas?
Yeah.
Okay, Keith Thomas. That's a name from the past. So, so then after that, Mr. Hargrove, and then much later after that, Mr. Tom Turk and others. So anyway, we won't argue that point. It's not crucial. We were adding feast sites every year, and our attendance was growing 30% year over year. And that was for a lot of years. I mean, if you were to plot it on a graph, it was like looking at a hockey stick going up. A lot like a hockey stick, exactly like a hockey stick. It was amazing and astounding growth. It plateaued in the mid-1970s, and really it kind of had to, didn't it? Because if it hadn't plateaued at some point, everybody in the world would be in the church right now. I mean, at a 30% growth rate, that geometric growth would have just... I tell you what, it was an exciting time, you young people. It was an exciting time to be a part of the Church of God. As Ambassador College students, we were continually encouraged to prepare yourselves for a life of service. A life of service. And we don't know how much longer this work is going to continue. And we took that very seriously. We really did, because we could see the results of it, because as students, we had jobs in various parts of the church. And like I was, you know, a little janitor in, you know, as a freshman, going down to the presses every day and seeing these massive amounts of magazines and booklets being produced. And then I walked through the letter answering areas, and you could see the letters that were just stacked on each individual's desk. By the time you were a junior or senior, some people were assigned to be in the letter answering department. Here from there, from England, they answered all the letters from Europe and all the letters from Africa and all the letters from everywhere else except for the United States and Canada. And even South America, even the Spanish-speaking areas of the world were orchestrated from that area in England for quite some time. And it was very impressive. People have questions, and they write in, and they're asking these vital questions of life. And somebody sitting down and taking the time to write out an answer, you just can't imagine the scope of it if you weren't there. And even those of you that have been around for a while, if you never visit the college campuses and walk through some of these areas, then you really wouldn't know how big it was. And the phrase "the gun lap" was an analogy that originated with Herbert Armstrong. And of course, now we know, of looking back, that it was his fervent wish and desire that he would see the work which had begun with him in the 1920s that resulted in radio and then worldwide Church of God culminate in the return of Jesus Christ. That was his often stated goal, and it didn't happen. The movement and the progress of spreading the gospel, for those of you that were there, was like a steamroller. And if you didn't climb on board, you were likely to get run over by all the inertia of that entire thing. So I know that some of you are far too young to remember the state of the world at those times. But there was turbulence, and there was a rapidly changing culture and mores which helped fuel the idea that indeed we were on the gun lap, and there couldn't be much time left to promulgate the gospel of God's coming kingdom, and we wouldn't have that much time to complete it. At different times through those years, now again, for those of you and many of us now, we've evolved into a different age. We've evolved from an age in which there was a lot of print media, a lot of newspapers, a lot of magazines. So this may not resonate with you as well, but some of you that might be a little bit older, my age, maybe a little bit older, maybe a little bit younger, there were magazines that were big in those days, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, lesser extent, the 70s. But there was Life magazine, which was one of the most popular weekly magazines. It wasn't a news magazine. There was Look magazine, which was a rival to Life magazine. There were other news magazines which were also popular in a way, called news magazines, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report. They're basically all gone now. You know, they may have electronic versions of them, but Life and Look magazine, and then the largest circulation monthly magazine of all, Reader's Digest. At one time, we were in all three of these magazines. We had ads asking important questions like, why were you born? And stimulating such a response that they had to pull back. They had to pull back on the ad buy, not because they didn't have the money, but because they couldn't handle the incredible response rate. Now, response rates are not nearly so good in this day and age for various cultural reasons, but back in that day, that was building a church. That was building a people. That was fueling this unbelievable growth that was happening in those days. Reader's Digest, everybody's favorite magazine and probably the highest rated publication in the world at that time. A little tear out card, mail it in, United States and Britain in prophecy, just hope you have enough of those booklets to send out. And they did. It was incredible. Some of you will remember this. When you went to the Feast of Tabernacles, some of you, when you first started coming in, when you first started attending the feast, you could get lost at one of our feast sites. Mr. LaRavia, you watching, you'll remember this, right? You were part of that. You could get lost. There'd be 10, 12, 14,000 people at our own festival sites. You cannot hardly remember that time, can you? Some of you. It's hard. It's like when I was speaking about what happened after the captivity and the Jews coming back to Jerusalem. You know, they laid the foundation, and some people cried, some people rejoiced, but they knew that, wow, know, what we had way back then, 70 years ago, was so incredible. We had a nation. We had a temple. And look at us now. There's only 63,000 people that returned. We built our own back then in those days, late 60s, early 70s, didn't have community centers, didn't have big meeting rooms, had to build our own. Build our own festival sites, and we did, in the Poconos, in the Ozarks, in the Dells, those Big Sandy. Those areas would have 10, 12, 14,000 people. I remember even later when I graduated from Ambassador College, went to the Poconos in 1975. We had 12,000 to 13,000 people there, and then just in the next state, in Niagara Falls, we had another 5 or 6,000 when they started finally building some of these community centers, like Tucson Community Center. We had, you know, 7,500 people on a regular basis here in Tucson. I know there's rumors there was like 9,000 people here. No, there never was 9,000 people here. I have the statistics, believe me. I know all the statistics. I have them still. I had them. I was kind of a – there was a lot, though. There was 7,000 for sure, 7,500 at times. And then when we had to expand to some of these other community centers. Here's something. Here's a little known fact that some of you old-timers probably don't even know. How many of you have ever been to the Big Sandy campus, the old Big Sandy campus? Okay? All right. You were there. So and hopefully we've got the website working. I just hope that's working because I hate to hear the reports that, we're not getting this. So anyway, but in Big Sandy, the original idea before they built the tabernacle where it is now, and that held 12, 14,000 people, the original idea that Mr. Armstrong had and that he wrote to the members about in member letters was that this was kind of unheard of at the time. This is late 60s. They would build a structure that could be expanded to hold up to 25,000 people. But in those days, engineering-wise, they were talking with the steel companies that made those buildings like we made in all those areas eventually. But this was early. This was late 50s, early 60s. The plan, the vision that Mr. Armstrong had was that most of that tabernacle building would be below ground level. And they even began excavation in Big Sandy, where the top levels would almost be even with the ground, so you wouldn't have a whole lot to support in the air, structurally speaking. And that's what they were thinking about at that particular time. It was even called Buck's Bowl, after Buck Hammer, who was the son of Roy Hammer, and the Hammer family had been the one that had donated thousands of acres to the church, and eventually the college was built there. Later, the idea was scrapped, and they turned it into a lake. It's called Lake Loma, and that's what happened to it. But the original idea with that particular area of the property to the north of where the student housing, some of the student housing, the Booth City area was that it would be the site of a huge building because we were growing that much. We needed a place to where people could, I mean, they had plenty of camping space, and the church was growing so fast and becoming relatively large by today's standards that as a member, you knew that you were kind of in the ground floor of something, big, right? Something huge that was bursting onto the scene. And you were. You were. We knew we weren't part of a church with some kind of fuzzy history with, Peter going to Rome and establishing a church. Now, how much sense historically does that really make when you think about it? When you think about, okay, wait a minute, this church, which had been opposed, and the Jews, basically a Jewish church to begin with, the Jews had been held down and oppressed by this Roman Empire for many years. How much sense does it make that the true Church of God would trace its historical antecedents back to a church that was eventually taken over by that empire, and that empire named it as the official religion of the empire. Remember the Romans? Remember how they hunted down the Jews at Masada, those Jewish rebels? This same Roman Empire became a Christian organization with Peter at its head at Rome. That might be something we might cover. You can actually prove from the Bible that Peter never went to Rome. He's never there. But that's what popular myth has, that Peter was always the first pope. No, we don't trace our historical antecedents to that fuzzy history, because when you came into the church, you learned about the true church of God. The true church of God that was established in 31 AD. And you knew that very, very well. And you knew that there was a counterfeit church that was named as the religion of the Roman Empire. This empire that, so all of a sudden somehow became so beneficent and so Christian. The same one that went to Mount Masada and built another mountain right next to that mount in order to get up there and find those Jews and kill them. They became Christian. Not hardly. You knew that as a member of the Church of God. So let's take a look at some of the lessons that we learned long ago that we all need to keep in mind for as long as we live. I'm just going to give a caveat here to begin with. Yeah, there were some down times. There were some extremes in the past. I'm not going to talk about those things today, because what I'm here to talk about are some of the lessons that are good that we learned from the gun lap. There were. The first one is this, and I'll frame it in this way. Very early in the 20th century, the people of God knew this. They knew that God's plan of salvation is undeniably going to be eventually for all mankind. That God will seek everyone to be in his kingdom at some time, but not yet. And the Church of God knew that all through the 20th century. We'd go to a lot of places, but there's one chapter, Matthew 13, that spells this out so well. We might just stay right there for this first, for this part. And a lot of this I have to skip over because of time, but I'm assuming that the audience that I'm dealing with is so sophisticated, and they are, that you know the topic of this chapter very, very well. And Christ is teaching, and he begins with a parable, the parable of the sower. And in verse 4, he sowed, and some seed fell by the wayside, and birds came and devoured them, that is, the seed. And some seed fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were all scorched, kind of like my flowers are in this incredible, incredible furnace of a dry heat that we have. I digress. Because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And Christ goes through the rest of the chapter and explains that you're only going to have ears to hear and understand the meaning of this parable if God calls you to understand. And he mentions to his disciples who asked them, why are you speaking parables, verse 10? And he said, because it is given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. Most people are just not going to get it, because when you get it, you're accountable for it. This is in another famous teaching. Christ said, it's not the time of figs yet, when he cursed the fig tree. It's not the time of universal salvation. There will be a time of that eventually. The Holy Day plan spells that out for us. There will be a time when everyone will be called and offered salvation. That's going to be happening at some point in the future, of course. But he quoted the prophecy of Isaiah, and he said, "Hearing you will hear and shall not understand, and seeing you will see and not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull, their ears are hard of hearing, their eyes have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts in turn that I should heal them." This was a lesson that everyone in the church learned when they were called. Now, they didn't learn it immediately, like a lot of us. I mean, we thought, oh, man, my zeal? This is so plain. I can explain this to my friends, to my family. I can do this so easily because it came so easy to you. You realize that your eyes were opened, as it says in verse 16, to the disciples, "For they see, and your ears, for they hear. For assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it." Therefore, the parable of the sower, you know, it prevails. We didn't initially always know that at the time. Conversion of relatives, preaching to others is pretty common. Pretty common, not so common today, as we've learned that lesson. But we knew that this was not the time for the calling of the entire world to salvation. And that's basically the premise of the entire chapter. Whether you're speaking about the parable of the sower, or beginning in verse 24, another parable he put forth to them, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field, but while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way." Explaining what happened in the second, third, and fourth centuries after the church was established, that heresies came into the church, and there were tares that came in and totally turned around the true gospel. And beginning in verse 31, another parable he put forth to them, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed which a man took and sowed in his field." And next verse, it shows that this mustard seed is transformed into a big tree, where all the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. Some people think, some commentators think, I know, oh, that's just talking about the explosion of the kingdom of God when Christ returns. Well, the entire chapter is talking about what happens when God's word goes forth in this age, not in the age to come. So, the point is, God is very inclusive. It just takes time. It takes a period of time. And we knew and we understood that this is not the time of the calling of the world to salvation, which made what happened during the gun lap even all that more special. With all the problems that were going on in the world at that time, it was incredible. Because you began to understand that the holy days of God outline a salvation plan for mankind that is so generous and so beautiful. And it's just not happening right now. So, my brother and I stopped trying to convert my parents. In fact, I think it was on Christmas Day. I'll have to double check this. I think it was on Christmas Day, was a Sabbath in 1971. And it was snowing so hard in Western Maryland that they may have had some people show up at church services, but I had a mountain to cross, and it was about a foot deep when I was about ready to leave for church services at 8 o'clock in the morning. And my dad said, "Look, I still see the Christmas tree." My parents had, you know, they were very disappointed I didn't participate in that. It was the first Christmas I didn't participate in. My dad looked at me and said, "Son," he's very... very considerate. I, in my zeal, wanted to get in my Volkswagen, you know, rear-wheel drive, no weight in the front, and drive over a mountain. That would have been really smart, you know, with those bias tires at that time. "You're not going to go anywhere. I can't miss services. Can't miss." There was that attitude. You can't miss. Terry grew up in the church, and her parents drove 165 miles one way. Getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to make, what were services in those days, 10 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning, driving up from near Brownsville, Texas, all the way to Corpus Christi. They hadn't established a church in the Rio Grande Valley at that time. They got in this old, I think, Ford or something. Maybe it was a different car, but 50s, some car. Big old huge thing. They'd set up, they'd make blankets. The kids would sleep. Terry and her brother would sleep all the way up. People did a lot of things. Drove a lot of miles. They're very, very zealous. Wanted to go to church on Christmas Day, but Dad wouldn't let me. We realized that this wasn't the time in which salvation would be offered to all mankind, but it would be the building of the temple of God, which we've talked about recently, a temple that God is building that will be there in place when Christ returns. And Christ said in Matthew 24, right, took this very, very seriously, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. You know, all these things that are mentioned in the Olivet Prophecy will come to conclusion, which leads us to the next big lesson from the Gunlap. Next big lesson. These are my observations. There's nothing you can find in our literature that talks about this, but or this outline that I've prepared. But we knew that this church would preach the gospel. It would preach the gospel. The church of God is entrusted with the gospel, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached around the world as a witness to all nations, and in the end will come. And there were many opportunities that became available to the church of God during those years. Many doors were opened, and we walked through them. Really, in many cases, it wasn't really a matter of having enough funds to walk through some of those doors. It was a matter of waiting for the doors to open and walking through them. And it was a gospel of the kingdom of God, not a gospel of the person of Jesus Christ. That was a big distinction for a lot of people who had grown up in other churches. It was a kingdom that was not of this earth, but one that would be established on the earth. That was big. We knew that. The church of God understood that and realized it. That was a part of such a huge part and is such a huge part of our belief system, that it would be established on this earth, and prior to that, there would be all of these other attendant signs that would come to pass that are outlined here in Matthew 24. And then in Matthew 28, another thing taken very seriously about the church preaching the gospel is mentioned in verse 19. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And we did that. And raised up churches in South Africa and Australia and New Zealand, in Britain, in France, many different countries, in Germany, all over the world, and kept expanding and expanding and expanding as far as we could take it. We also realized that it was a church that Christ said in Luke 12 and verse 32 was a little flock, which leads us to another lesson. Let's look at the context in Luke chapter 12 and verse 32. Luke 12, 32, do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Even when we are massive in terms of our size and population in the church, relatively speaking to today, which is about maybe with all the various groups, sister groups, right? I mean, maybe just still fractionally a size of what Worldwide Church of God was in its heyday, but still a lot of zeal in all those people. Every one of those people. It says in verse 33, sell what you have and give alms. Provide for yourselves money bags which do not grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And notice also this. Verse 35, let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. This is explained in other parts of the Bible, like Ephesians 6, the armor of God. It was a hallmark of the people of God and is today. For you yourselves be like men who wait for their master, when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. And if you should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them, blessed are those servants. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Doing what? What will those servants be doing? Well, one of the answers that we gave was the work. And everyone in the church was encouraged to realize their potential, their part in the work, no matter how small, in promulgating that gospel of the kingdom of God. That's a part of it. We learned that we always needed to be ready. Always needed to be ready, not just when you see the escalation of world events. You know, the prophecy understanding, the updates that I'm doing, you know, I just want to do them. The understanding of prophecy is a good thing. But we found out this, that the understanding of prophecy is not going to lead to salvation. It doesn't lead anybody to salvation. It's kind of nice to know the world that you live around in, but the most important aspect of your life, we learned that we needed to be spiritually ready no matter what the times. And we learned that an understanding of prophecy isn't the be-all and the end-all. We learned about spiritual growth in Matthew chapter 25. These are just reminders here. We learned about spiritual growth as members of the Church of God that was growing dramatically through those years. I came in at the tail end of it. But when I went to Ambassador College, I met a lot of people. I met a lot of people from all over the world, and I met people who had been a part of this explosive growth, even in England, where they didn't. Now, times are changed. Times are changed since then. There was really no freedom of religion, so to speak, like what we had always enjoyed in this country. You couldn't get on a radio station in England and preach the gospel. They wouldn't. It was all government owned. It was all government controlled. You couldn't do that. So somebody got the bright idea of broadcasting on these pirate stations that were off the coast of England. These pirate stations were playing the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and all the popular rock groups of the day. And guess what happened? There were a bunch of young people that were listening to rock music that came into the church in England. Because Herbert Armstrong came on and the World Tomorrow broadcast came on. And then combining that with Radio Luxembourg going throughout all of Europe, it was some incredible stuff. And eventually shut down those pirate stations. But it was interesting. I met some of those people. And when I got to Ambassador College, I learned about the history of the Church of God, at least in the 20th century. I learned a lot of it from Herbert Armstrong himself, who came there so often. And then the individuals that he personally taught in the early days of Ambassador College, many of them were there. And a lot by that time I had gotten there in 1972, there had been almost a generation of people that had gone through Pasadena as students and were now ministers. And I learned a lot of that stuff. So I had kind of a shortcut to church history that a lot of people were not necessarily privy to. But we learned about Matthew 25, and we learned about spiritual growth. We learned of the parable of the talents, and we knew what this meant for us. To whom much is given, much is expected. If you're given access to the Holy Spirit of God, you are expected to use it. You are expected to develop as an individual. And we were a praying church and a church that studied. And we looked at the Bible to instruct us, to change us, to guide us. The work of God was encouraging, exciting, and engaging. all good lessons from being on the gun lap. Yeah, it was a long gun lap. Still going on, by the way. But it was still good. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 20. Ephesians 4:20. Break into the sentence here, but you have not so learned Christ. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lust. This was a teaching, a preaching of Christianity that involved change. Not just as I am, as the song says. God doesn't want you as you are. You're expected to change and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. And how does that happen? How is God actually working in you, and what is the proof? You got to stop doing some things that you've been doing. Therefore, putting away lying, let each of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we're members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. The Bible is a book about change. A book about change and changing your life. And during this time, some of you are going to remember this. During this time, what happened every so often? This church was accused of being a church that taught salvation by works. Oh, you're trying to earn your salvation, especially when it came to the Sabbath day. Oh, you're just trying to earn salvation. That's what the knock was in keeping the Sabbath. You never heard anyone say, oh, all you people in the church of God, all you people who are not taking God's name in vain, you're just trying to earn salvation, aren't you? All you people that are just trying to honor your parents, all you're doing is trying to earn salvation, aren't you? You never heard that. Came down to the Sabbath. Sabbath is a sign. Sabbath is a test. And all you people out there who aren't committing adultery, oh boy, you're just trying to earn your salvation. That's all you're trying to do. No, we understood that when we came or we were brought to the church of God, the Bible, the Word of God, was the foundation of the church. The words of the prophets and the apostles demanded our change, demanded that we not remain the same. And we knew on the gun lap that we were and expected to make progress. Just as I am, Lord, doesn't cut it. It's a message that still resonates today to all of us. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5 says, therefore put to death your members which are on the earth. What's he talking about? Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. Because the fruits of all of that lifestyle bring about the need for God's intervention. If everyone was perfect, they wouldn't need all of that. In which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them, but now you yourselves are to put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Don't lie to one another, since you put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. We're to become like Christ. One final lesson, and there are many, many more from the gun lap, but one final lesson that I'll share with you today that we learned. We come to this. The gun lap isn't a sprint to the finish. There's lots of jostlings on the curve and bunching up, people falling down. Remember the Olympic race of a heralded American runner many years ago, maybe 30 years ago, Francine LaRue. And she got stuck in one of those kind of bunched up groups for her distance race, which I think was like 3 miles or whatever it was in the Olympics. And she was one of the favorites to win. She was kind of had failed a couple of times in previous Olympics, and she got flat knocked down in her race. One of the things that we learned is that there's no finish in the flesh, that this race is a race of endurance. It's an endurance race, not a sprint, even if you're on that last lap. Paul makes it very clear by comparison several times, 3 times, in fact, if you believe he's the author of Hebrews, and since I do, because even though he's not named, because he talks about writing from his chains, the book of Hebrews. So 2 times anyway, if you don't believe he's the author of Hebrews, and it really doesn't matter what either of us believe, but 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 24 says, "Do you not know that those who run a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it." The analogy remains. It's a good analogy or metaphor, whatever you wish. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7, Paul said, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith." And he also mentions in Acts 20 and verse 24 that he had won the race that was set before him as he left the Ephesian elders. We learned during the gun lap the lesson of endurance. And there are a number of specific lessons of endurance that we all need to learn. Being a Christian means you're in a race and you are competing. You're competing to win. You want to win. You want to be a winner. You're involved. Not a passive once a week diversion like, "Oh, okay, it's nice to come to church." Although, boy, come to church. Be there. Be at church. Come to Sabbath services. This is life. It's not just showing up. Paul says in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 14, "I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." We learned the lessons of endurance. We did. Good job. Endurance is the ability or strength to continue or last, especially despite fatigue, stress, or other adverse conditions. It means having stamina. Well, by those who are here today, you've got stamina, you've passed the test. In the book of Hebrews in chapter 6, Hebrews chapter 6, endurance is mentioned a lot. Talks in the first few verses about fundamental doctrines. Actually talks about the calling of God, how that happens, how that occurs, how your life begins to be transformed and changed. It's all God's doing. It's not because you wanted it. You may have wanted it, but, you know, God didn't act on your desire. He acted on His desire. He chose you. Talks about a falling away in verse 6, as you know. And in verse 10, we read, "God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you've shown toward His name, and that you've ministered to the saints and do minister." Whatever you have done since you thought the gun lap was over, it's not in vain. It's not in vain. "And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end, that you do not become sluggish, but imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises." Yeah, it's incredible. Some of the lessons of endurance we have learned, and some we may not have learned just yet. Verse 15 says, "So after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise." Patience is a part of endurance. Chapter 10 and verse 32, But recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings. Probably some sufferings have applied, you could say they applied to God's people in times of sickness and other calamity and that sort of thing, but not every single person has suffered, had a great deal of suffering, people as they would classify suffering. Verse 27 of chapter 11 talks about Moses, that he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. We haven't had to endure that kind of thing in our lives. Chapter 12 and verse 2 says, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." We haven't endured always shame and pain. Verse 3, looking unto Jesus, then it also says hostility as well. Verse 7, correction. We've endured correction, made it through. Yes, sure we have at times. So were there some mistakes along the way back in the early years? Oh, yeah. That's, I'm not being selective today. Believe me, I was there. You were there. We did some things. Sometimes in some areas, dates were set, incorrect understanding of prophecies and that sort of thing. But sometimes we created problems where there didn't need to be. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 32, we read, "But recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with suffering." Yes, sometimes we did. But we're also admonished to run with endurance the race that is set before us in chapter 12 and verse 1, reflecting on those that have gone before. Now, it could be even those who you've known that have died in the faith. It could be all those that are mentioned in chapter 11 of Hebrews. They endured quite a bit. I guess when I first began to hear about the Gunlap, I didn't really think much about endurance as much as I could have. But now we know that retrospectively, it's not a sprint. It's more like a marathon. The Christian life is a marathon. Philippides, a Greek runner, brought news in 490 BC that the Battle of Marathon against the Persians had been won by the Greeks. And he ran that distance from Marathon to Athens. And what you didn't know probably was that the past couple of days prior to that, he had run over 150 miles, according to some legends. He ran a long ways. And that is the distance, which the modern marathon has calculated, a distance of some 26 miles, a little bit in the excess of 26 miles. And so it's no surprise this young man, this courier, when he arrived in Athens, said, "We win," or something like that, and then collapsed and fell dead. Unfortunate. We don't want that kind of end for any of you. But through the last couple of decades, there's... Okay, I'm calculating exactly how I'm going to put this, so I know. The last couple of decades, since you've endured since that time, there's been a tendency on the part of some to place the blame or the demise of the church that was once one that had been growing in an exponential way, and then all of a sudden that stopped and that church transformed, to place the demise of that group of people on a person or a small cadre of people who exerted a great deal of influence on the body that was then known as Worldwide Church of God. It's natural. And you know what? They did all those things. They did those things. But does it explain it, really? And one of my favorite... Well, you know I like movies. You know that John Wayne's probably my favorite actor of all time. I know he is Terry's. One of my favorite John Wayne movies is Chisholm. Now, how many of you have ever seen that movie? All right. Now I'm speaking to the right audience. That's good. In this movie, John Chisholm is a cattle baron who is won a great part of the state of New Mexico, or the New Mexico Territory, by blood, sweat, and tears and Indian fighting and everything. And so this shows him later on in life, this movie, where he has one final showdown against another would-be kind of really bad person. Couldn't think of anything else. Sorry. It's not well scripted, is it? And they get into this huge fight at the end. And in the movie, this is part of the fictional aspect of it, that Billy the Kid is cast as a character that is kind of turning for the good on the good side for a while. Not real good, but kind of good. Anyway, watch the movie. And he comes up to John Wayne at the end of the movie when the battle is ended and John Wayne has won again, thankfully. And he apologizes to John Chisholm for starting the whole thing. And John Wayne says, "You were the primer, Billy, but sooner or later, the lid had to blow off." Well, in the same way, it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 19, Paul told the Corinthians that there had to be factions among them so that those approved could be shown to be the ones that were also recognized among them. Sooner or later, the lid had to blow off. That's what I've come to. If there were those who were approved in Paul's day, then there were those who weren't approved as well. And 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1 says that the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. Some may have been the primer, but in the end, everybody had to make their own decision and their own life's choices. You know what that's called? Well, I don't know what it's called, but you know what it is? It's endurance. It's endurance. So to our younger, maybe even our older generation, we did indeed learn lessons from being a part of the gun lap. And we're always going to be on the gun lap until Christ returns.